From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Bolivia's MAS party is celebrating a year after a right-wing coup that deposed the popular president Evo Morales, and after two election delays, the Socialist Party proclaimed a huge victory for democracy after a landslide win on Sunday for presidential candidate and Morales' ally Luis Arce. Morales had been banned by the post-coup government of Jeanine Añez from running for president or even for a congressional seat. He remains currently exiled in Argentina. While there, he hailed Arce's victory as, quote, a great triumph of the people. My guest is Guillaume Long, senior research fellow at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He's also a former Ecuadorian politician and academic who served as Minister of Foreign Affairs of Ecuador and Human Mobility in the government of Rafael Correa. He was previously the Minister of Culture and Heritage and Minister of Knowledge and Human Talent. He later became Ecuador's permanent representative to the UN in Geneva before resigning in January 2018. Welcome to the program, Guillaume.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So first, let's talk about who Luis Arce is. He, I understand, was former economics or finance minister under Morales. Does his win represent a proxy win for Morales?
Yeah, I think it's a massive win for, obviously, for Evo Morales, who's been, as you were introducing, I mean, essentially forced into exile since the coup that took place last November. So evidently for Morales, it's a huge relief to have his former economy minister now win the elections, and his political party, the MAS, win the elections after a year of intense persecution against Morales himself, the main leaders of the MAS party, and the MAS itself, including major human rights abuses against some of MAS supporters and MAS sympathizers, two well-documented massacres last year. Sure, for Evo Morales, this is a big relief. This is the best case scenario. Now, the MAS is a very heterogeneous organization. It's a broad, it's not like what we imagine sometimes as a kind of political party in the Western sense, right? It's a broad alliance of movements, of parties, of unions, of community grassroots organizations. It's a very sort of very liquid, we would say nowadays, a broad alliance. But it is obviously something Morales created many years ago now. It is fundamentally his party. And even if it is heterogeneous and inside the party, there are all sorts of different factions, some closer to Morales and some much more distant to Morales. It is, of course, a huge reivindication for Morales. It's a vindication that he was toppled in a coup, which is what he's been arguing, and many of us have been arguing since last year, that this was done against the will of the majority of Bolivian people. And of course, this huge margin that's been announced and that's been recognized by all the political actors, including the losers in these elections, of, you know, more than over 50% in the first round, with over 20 points difference with the closest rival.
Which means there doesn't need to be a runoff, right?
No need for a runoff. It is obviously a huge vindication for Mr. Evo Morales himself, even if I think he's, you know, he's not going to play the role he's played in the past. He's made that clear. He's not going to be necessarily pulling the strings of Bolivian politics in the same way that he was before. So I think there are a number of changes we can discuss, but sure, absolutely. It's a huge relief, I imagine, and triumph for him personally.
Now, when Morales was essentially forced out, let's discuss the circumstances under which that happened last year. We had covered it on our program, but it's still worth bringing that back as context. You know, the mainstream media, especially here in the U.S., covered this as, oh, yet another left-wing president who's facing mass opposition from the public, and that he just became too authoritarian, extended his power. And of course, like many left-wing presidents, Morales is not perfect, but how did the mainstream media characterize the coup, which, you know, was basically what it was, and refused to use, how did they refuse to use the word coup?
Yeah, essentially, just you just said it. I mean, a lot of the media refused to admit that this was a coup. And this was, you know, I mean, there have been a lot of different types of coups. And then lately in Latin America, there have been some actually more sophisticated coups, I would argue, sort of parliamentary impeachment processes that are not grounded in the constitution or in the law, such as in Brazil, or, you know, trying to ban and block candidates from running in Brazil, certainly against Lula, and in Ecuador and in other places. But this was, you know, as close as a textbook coup can be, right? The army, but first a police mutiny, refusing to guarantee law and order on the streets. So security forces very much present in the rebellion in November last year. You know, the coup was on November 10th. And on the day, there was a police mutiny. And then later on in the afternoon, the chiefs of staff, I suppose, would be the US equivalent, the head of the different forces in the army, asking Morales to, or suggesting was the term they used, Morales to step down, right? So, I mean, had he not stepped down, obviously, they would have rebelled, they would have taken power. You know, it was a coup, and his successor was sworn in a very irregular fashion, and the presidential sash was, bestowed onto her actually by a military officer, right? So, you know, it was a coup, and it's very, worrying that a lot of the Western press didn't cover it as such, especially as I think two important points. First, Morales hadn't finished his term, and there was no discussion as to him winning the elections back in 2014, right? This was never, you know, there was 2 months left for him to finish his term. There was no discussion as to whether he was, at the time of the coup, the constitutional president, the elected president, as the first point. So that was certainly a coup against an elected incumbent president. But also the second point, which was he'd just been re-elected with, you know, an important margin, you know, over 10 points difference with his closest rival. Mas was in first place. Of course, then there's this whole narrative we might talk about again, that the OAS starts spinning regarding whether the elections were fraudulent or not. You know, the think tank I work for, SIPA, has argued now for a year that there was no evidence to the OAS's accusations that the elections were fraudulent. And if anything, I think the last elections that Arce has just won, that the MAS just won, sort of, again, confirmed the notion that the MAS is still very much a very strong party and that the elections were not fraudulent last year. But, you know, it was a double coup, if you like. It was a coup against a sitting incumbent president who hadn't finished his term, and it was also a coup against elections which Evo Morales had won.
So let's talk about who Luis Arce is and what now happens with MAS. With such a large margin of victory, what does Bolivia's future hold? And can Morales even return to his home country, whether or not he re-enters government?
So Arce is Morales's former Minister of Economy, Finance Minister, if you like. It's important to understand that during the 14-year rule of Evo Morales, the economy did very well. The Bolivian economy was one of the most thriving economies in Latin America. In fact, globally, it was held as one of the examples of economic success. Bolivian GDP multiplied during those 14 years, taking into account that Bolivia was the poorest country in South America. Poverty, equality dropped drastically. And, you know, the Bolivian economy was hailed as a success story, and largely because, of course, President Morales, but also his Minister of the Economy, Luis Arce, who's just been elected president of Bolivia. So I think it's very important to understand that in this current circumstance, I would say in Bolivia and elsewhere in Latin America, where you're having a return to neoliberalism accompanied by, you know, a spiraling of poverty. Poverty is on the rise again in Bolivia and in other countries in Latin America. Inequality is on the rise again. There is no growth. You know, neoliberalism is not just unfair, as Keynesian economists often repeat. It's also sort of unsuccessful at creating capital accumulation, even for the elites, right? The only thing neoliberalism recreates is inequality. It maintains the relative positions of dominance in a society, but it doesn't actually create more accumulation of capital. And so in this context, you're seeing the architect of that economic success story being re-elected and promising to bring the state back in, to bring sort of common sense back to sort of economic management, and to move away from the sort of fundamentalist, hyper market driven, flexibilization driven, flexibilization of everything in the management of the Bolivian economy, which was what we saw under the coup regime of Jeanine Áñez, a real return to the politics of privatization, of deregulation, of flexibilization of labor, flexibilization of capital flows. And of course, for a country which still needs to consolidate the social contract, which still needs to have tax reform and all sorts of things, and in the context of the COVID crisis also, which requires important public investment, this was bound to fail, and it failed miserably. Bolivia's on the tracks for minus 8% GDP this year, so I think the calculation of the mass was to have a candidate that would distill confidence to Bolivians, to Bolivian voters. This person was competent, and he would manage the economy in a responsible way, and that, obviously there's some nostalgia there as well. You would be seeing a return of economic good governance in these times.
And the fact that he was the finance minister of the socialist government of Morales is particularly symbolic. Certainly, I'm looking at a Washington Post article on October 16th, so just days before the election, that characterized the election as a test for Latin American socialism and democracy. And I think the Post really got it wrong, saying that the nation was, that Bolivia was heading toward a bitterly disputed presidential vote on Sunday, the outcome of which could spark violence regardless of the winner. We now know, of course, that it was a landslide victory for Morales. And it said that the result could have broad implications across the region. So does Arce's win in Bolivia mean something bigger and broader than just Bolivia? How can it reverberate across Latin America?
I think it's being read in Latin America by both left and right as a very important moment, as a turning point. The left has been, by and large, since 2014, 2015 in Latin America, a bit on the back foot. There are a number of factors for this, most importantly, political fatigue after, in some cases, a decade or a decade and a half of the left being in government. People sort of understandably wanted to vote for the opposition, wanted some democratic, change. But the story since the right's being in power in Latin America in the last 3 or 4 years, in most Latin American countries, has been really bad. We've seen, a return of a very aggressive form of neoliberalism, something resembling the policies of the 80s and the 90s, accompanied by large IMF loans, capital flight, the use of tax havens on an unprecedented scale in the contemporary history of Latin America. So all these things have returned, and voters were maybe, after a little bit of seeing the same faces for 10 or 15 years, understandably voted for the opposition, but that doesn't necessarily mean they were voting for these really aggressive right-wing neoliberal programs. That's in the case where the neoliberals were elected, but of course in the case of Bolivia, neoliberals weren't elected. They arrived via coup. So I think the fact that people in Bolivia voted on such a large scale in favor of Bolivian socialism, to simplify, really is being seen as a vindication again in Latin America of the pink tide, of the progressive leftist governments in Latin America. And it's also being perceived as a turning point, as a first of a number of victories. Of course, there are elections next week in Chile to overturn the Pinochet constitution. There are elections in February in Ecuador, where Correa's successor could be elected. There are elections in Brazil next year, so on and so forth. There are a series of elections where the left could be making significant gains. And, you know, a lot of people who are saying the pink tide is over, well, right now their voices are certainly muted. And there are a lot of other people saying the pink tide could be back.
What is Arce's main challenge now in Bolivia? It's been a year since the right-wing coup government of Jeanine Añez fomented a crackdown. Dozens of people have been killed, hundreds injured during protests. And as you've mentioned, the security forces cracking down. 1 year is a long time, but compared to other coups, maybe not so long. Do you expect that he's going to be able to heal the nation going forward and bring up some sort of accountability for the post-coup government and their actions?
So sure. So this is I would say, to a certain extent, it's a trade-off what you've just presented. I mean, on the political front, he faces a huge challenge, because of course, on the one hand, you know, you've had the largest human rights abuses that you've had in any Latin American, well, possibly with the exception of Honduras, but you know, I mean, pretty much in any Latin American country in the last few years, some would argue decades. What we've seen in Bolivia was a really hard right, neo-fascist in some regards, regimes. So obviously, and there were massacres. So
and remind us, why did Jeanine Añez herself not run in the elections?
Well, because the polls,
she was deeply unpopular.
Deeply unpopular. She would say no chance that she would win. So she thought, I better back somebody else on the right, transfer via votes to him. In this case, it was Carlos Mesa. There were also lots of rumors.
Who's
The former president of Bolivia. And so she tried to make a deal with Carlos Mesa so that, you know, by transferring her meager votes to him, he would then protect her, you know, and she wouldn't face all these particular, you know, potential repercussions, including legal repercussions for her actions, right? So I think Arce's main challenge is, of course, that kind of trade-off between, on the one hand, healing the wounds, I think you said, you know, trying to really create a national project, lift the nation up from this division, from this polarization, and move forward with this national project. But on the other hand, you know, facing the authors of some of the massacres, you know, Sencata and Sacaba massacres that happened last year, the massacres on huge scales with dozens of people that were killed by the security forces, which by the political left, by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which is an appendage to the OAS, and so on and so forth. So there are things that he needs to do. He's going to have to be firm on certain issues, politically I'm talking, but also sort of lenient on others. That mix is the challenge he faces politically. And of course, the other big challenge is the economy. And the economy, has been on a terrible downturn this year. It's going to have to revert all sorts of very nefarious policies that have huge impacts on social rights, on labor rights, particularly. Revert some of the privatization he's already announced, and deal with the COVID crisis. He's going to be sworn in November. We still don't have an exact date because the Bolivians have a different system and we didn't know whether there was going to be a second round. Now that we know that there isn't going to be a runoff, he's going to be sworn in November. So very much still in the midst of this pandemic, which he has to deal with, which we know creates problems for the economy. So he's got a tough road ahead. But he's got a landslide, he's got political legitimacy, and he's the fruit of a deeply democratic process we're going to see the results. I think it's going to be even a higher vote because we're following the vote count.
Right.
I think it's going to be actually higher than the exit polls have predicted. So probably in the mid-50s, maybe high 50s, we'll see. It's a huge triumph for him. It's huge legitimacy to carry out his policies and start fresh.
Let's talk about the United States. Jeanine Añez's government after the coup was backed by the U.S., but did the U.S. play the traditional role that has played in the past in supporting and in some cases actively fomenting right-wing coups via the military?
Yeah, I mean, I'm particularly convinced. I think this journalists still have a big role to play to find out exactly what happened last year in October, November, and how the coup actually unfolded in Bolivia. Hopefully it'll be journalists and we won't have to wait for historians. But I'm convinced that the US played a significant role in the coup. They certainly legitimized it as soon as it happened. They recognized a new government. They supported it. They backed it. They've been very close to it. You've had high-profile visits from this illegitimate government visiting Washington and being received, you know, very generously by all sorts of think tanks, by the State Department. You know, the U.S. has really given it its full support. So that's terrible. I think it's been the...
But it's par for the course, right? I mean, it's quite consistent with the...
It's consistent. I think it's been particularly bad during the Trump administration. They've really been very close to not just right-wing, elite Latin American governments we've seen for years, but like far-right, racist, some academics call them neo-fascist governments, you know, obviously Bolsonaro in Brazil, Anias in Bolivia, and others in the region, particularly in the context of the crackdown last year, from October 2019 onwards, before the pandemic, in fact, until the pandemic, huge wave of anti-neoliberal protests in Latin America. I remember talking to you about it last year in Ecuador, in Chile, in Colombia, of course, in Bolivia after the coup, with huge human rights abuses committed in a number of Latin American countries, and the U.S., with its puppet OAS, under the leadership of the Secretary General Almagro, very pro-Trump Almagro, just sanctioning all this and accepting all these human rights abuses, and obviously applying double standards because saying very bad things about Venezuela and Nicaragua and Cuba, but not saying anything about these very kind of far-right, right-wing regimes, including, of course, Bolivia. So I think there, U.S. policy towards Latin America, I would argue, has been problematic historically. But I have to say, under the Trump administration, it's been particularly bad at not identifying, human rights abuses. Actually, sort of mainstream human rights organizations have identified, actually, even pro-U.S., traditionally pro-U.S. human rights organizations have identified. So the fact that the U.S. didn't do it was even more sort of partisan than the U.S. usually is in Latin American politics.
And then, Guillaume, let's have a wrap up of this discussion discussing socialism in the age of COVID. In the United States, one of the things that has become so stark during this past 9 to 10 months is how difficult it is for market capitalism to deal with a crisis of this proportion. It has created greater popularity for the ideas of socialism and socialized medicine and socialized safety nets. In Latin America, with the COVID crisis, how has the ideological battle over socialism played out? And do you think that this COVID crisis will remind Latin American voters across the continent, and even in North America, say in Mexico and Central America, whether or not socialism or capitalism is the path in a world that's increasingly tenuous?
Now, that's a fascinating question, and I don't pretend that I have the answers to all those. I think the crisis obviously has, I don't know whether to call it positive impacts. I'm talking in ideological terms. Of course, we would all hope it hadn't happened. But it certainly, as you said, reminds us of the importance of socialized medicine, at the importance of the supremacy of human beings over capital, the supremacy of society over the market. You know, it brings ends and means. It kind of shuffles the correlation of ends and means and causation back into where it should be, right? Human life, human rights, human dignity, human health has to be the end of public policy and not just a means for the accumulation of capital. So in that sense, I think it's been positive. On the other hand, it's also been a very reactionary pandemic because it's been all about the deactivation of public space. I mean, in Latin America, COVID, the pandemic, essentially deactivated an unprecedented wave of protests for my generation. These were the biggest protests in Latin America in the last decades. In Ecuador, in my country, it was the biggest protest in my lifetime against the return of neoliberalism. And it was the pandemic that deactivated these protests and meant that the protesters had to go return to the private sphere, to the private place, whereas they were occupying the public sphere. Politically, they were politically mobilized them, the pandemic demobilized them. So that's been very negative. And in terms of the politics of it in Latin America, you would have thought the governments that have most protected their populations, that they enforced more the most responsible policies in terms of, you know, social distancing and getting the health system to work. Like, for example, the Argentine government, it's been very, you know, relatively successful compared to most of its neighbors. You would expect those to have been rewarded politically, but it's not always the case. You know, you've seen a major backlash, particularly by the middle classes and certainly by the upper classes in Argentina, against this kind of, you know, heralding kind of libertarian arguments. We want free movement. We don't want this quarantine anymore. We don't want social distancing. We don't want masks. And it's actually hurt the government. Whereas in Brazil, where there's been, you know, hundreds of thousands of deaths, you know, the second country in the world with the most amount of deaths after the United States, with completely irresponsible policies, with, like, you know, sort of anti-scientific arguments being pushed forward by the government, a bit like the Trump administration, you know, by the Bolsonaro administration, but in an even more extreme way, if that's possible, than the Trump administration. And yet you're not seeing the popularity of Bolsonaro sink. I mean, his popularity is not amazing, but you're not seeing sink to the extent you would expect it to sink. So, you know, it's not all good news, unfortunately. These kinds of, an almost, I would say, selfish survival of the fittest politics, where, you know, you're thinking about your own freedom of movement. You're not necessarily thinking about the vulnerability of your elders or people that are more vulnerable and that you could possibly pass the virus onto. Those politics, those very individualistic, sort of self-centered politics still thrive, unfortunately, and it's been the case as well in Latin America. So I would say it's this mixed bag for COVID. Some positive consequences in terms of our thinking, our way of thinking, in terms of health, in terms of socialized medicine, as you said, but also some quite depressing conclusions that we can draw about, not always enough solidarity in our societies, and that applies to Latin America too.
Guillaume, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to the Center for Economic and Policy Research's website so that people can find out more about your work. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Guillaume Long, Senior Research Fellow at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, former Ecuadorian politician and academic who served as Minister of Foreign Affairs of Ecuador and Human Mobility in the government of Rafael Correa. We've been discussing the mass victory in Bolivia. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.